I'll call to order the Senate. Call to order the Senate Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection. Today is March 30th, 2011, and we are convened to have public hearings, and most likely only public hearings, on the bills before us today. I wanted to give people a sense of how we're going to proceed, so that if your bill is late in and you have other obligations, you can come back. Senate Bill 889, we will hear first, and we're going to hear it for an hour. And I'll try to get as much testimony in as I possibly can. That means some of you will be asked to testify in 2 to 3 minute clips, and I might have to interrupt you so that we can have a chance to hear from as many people as possible. And from there, I think we will go to Senate Bill 490, Senate Bill 628, Senate Bill 577, 4th, and SJM 10, 5th. And there could be a chance that we run out of time and have to carry over SJM 10. So, that being said, why don't I open a public hearing on Senate Bill 889. Patrick, do you want to tee it up?
Oh, yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Senate Bill 889 creates an Oregon Financing and Credit Authority to formulate and implement investment and management policies and practices for state funds controlled and administered by state agencies. Authorize the authority to enter into contracts with state agencies for investment and management of state funds, make purchase guarantee and hold loans, purchase participation interest in investment and manage state funds. The bill directs the authority to adopt rules, requires a report to the Legislative Assembly on or before the date of convening of the 2013 regular session, and the measure has an emergency clause and would take effect upon passage, and this measure has subsequent referrals to the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee and the Joint Ways and Means Committee.
Wonderful. Senator Thompson, could you please join us? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great to be here. My name is Chuck Thompson. I'm Senator, District 26 from Hood River, and I have the pleasure of introducing for the first time in my short career a constituent that came all the way down from Hood River to testify today, and I wouldn't have missed this opportunity. I'd like to introduce you to Malin. He's the Chairman, President of Centerpoint Bank in Hood River and also in the Dalles area, Mid-Columbia. It's a great local bank. They do some great things down there. Just to let the committee know, I'm an expert on angiopairs. Maybe not on this issue, and I know you are the experts on this issue, but I wouldn't miss an opportunity to introduce Malin to you and say I've talked to him about banking issues, very in-depth, probably more in-depth than my brain can handle at times, but he's very knowledgeable, and I just wanted to welcome him to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Good luck. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think it would probably be appropriate to have the Treasurer's statements first.
If that's your preference, yes. Yep. We have a representative from the Treasurer's office if you'd like to join us. Welcome to the committee, Mike.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. And the State Treasurer, Ted Wheeler, is traveling on business today and he regrets that he's unable to attend. But he's asked me to read his statement into the record for him. And with the committee's permission, I will do so. Good afternoon. Oregon's economy, like that of the nation, was hit hard in the economic downturn of 2007 and 2008. And even though we see slight signs of growth, we are faced at every step with the realization that some elements of our economy have changed systemically, fundamentally, and permanently. What we now call the new normal is an economic landscape that forces us to rethink how we've structured the tools that buoyed us in years past and admit that those structures need to be reevaluated and reimagined in this context. When our local banks and credit unions are unable to lend, whether that's a result of regulation or simply a revised risk profile, we need to ask ourselves how we can effectively connect Oregonians to the resources that we do have available. when the state is facing a deep budget shortfall at a time when our families and farms need assistance the most, we need to ask what resources we haven't yet considered. And when our small businesses are struggling to keep pace with a burgeoning recovery that's posting record profits for Wall Street but leaving Main Street behind, we need to ask how we can get capital flowing again. Members of the committee, I'm going to put something on record that you might not often hear. I don't have all the answers.
His boss does, though.
For the record, that's the treasurer's words, not mine.
Is that perjury thing?
Fired now, I guess. But Senate Bill 889 provides a roadmap to what I see as a fruitful partnership between the state of Oregon, our existing system of local community banks and credit unions, and Oregonians who are looking for and ready to leverage economic opportunity. It's a first step and a good one. This bill has been labeled the State Bank Bill, despite the fact that it does not set up a capitalized financial institution. The result is going to be a bank in the sense that a bank can be a repository and coordinator of resources, like a seed bank or a blood bank. This will establish an economic development bank, so to speak. Oregon's economic development resources are currently spread across different agencies, fragmented and without meaningful alignment or clear priorities. The legislation calls for an interagency board to serve as a strategic coordinator for all of Oregon's economic development efforts, consisting of the governor, the treasurer, and the third member to be selected. It will be in a position to take a broad view of the state's disparate economic development programs, many of which are run by Business Oregon, but many of which are not, and also the resources that could be available for economic development in the future. The goal is to decrease fragmentation, establish clear priorities, and ensure that we get the maximum bang for our buck with the limited resources we have. The bill also sets up an advisory group made up of representatives of Oregon's business community, banks, credit unions, agricultural community, and other stakeholders to advise on fine-tuning that strategy and recommending further steps. Simply put, the bill provides what we have gone without, a unified framework into which we can build our economic development strategy. This entity will simply work within the existing agency framework, and at this point, we are not requesting any changes to the statutory sideboards of any existing funds. But I do expect that we will be able to identify new potential resources and ways to increase the flexibility and scope of the state's efforts. It's a modest first step, but it's just that, a first step. As we move forward, the state treasury is working on two programs that will add to this effort. First, a way to increase the activity of our community banks and credit unions. I am working with our congressional delegation to reform the way the FDIC protects public deposits. I believe that what we have proposed is a more efficient way to bring public dollars to bear on our economy and can be a powerful tool to restart our economic engine. Second, freeing up capital for the state to direct. The State Debt Policy Advisory Commission recently endorsed a plan to restructure state lottery debt and free up hundreds of millions of dollars that could be used in these economic development efforts. But these two plans alone have the potential to place billions of dollars in Oregon's local credit markets, but without the kind of unified framework provided by Senate Bill 889, we might as well be sowing our economic fields blindfolded. I can't speak for the rest of the eventual board, but I would emphasize these goals in coordinating these efforts. First, improve loan participation and credit enhancement tools seeded by these resources to encourage activity in industry sectors and regions that are vital to Oregon's continued economic well-being. Second, take on the types of loans that require lenders to keep skin in the game, so to speak, to ensure a well-mixed and secure portfolio. To use existing direct investment tools in concert with the strategy to fill the gaps when prudent, and to prioritize our bonding resources. Rather than allowing our bonded dollars to become political pawns, we should give precedence to the projects and funds that self-generate, draw in other resources, or complement the infrastructure needs of the very industries we're trying to grow. Oregon is a traded sector economy that will live or die on the strength of our transportation infrastructure. We have here an opportunity to do something valuable for our state's entrepreneurs, our existing small businesses, our family farms, and yes, our existing system of community banks and credit unions. We have the potential here to begin building a repository of resources with a unified plan of how we want to meet out those resources, and we have the capability to incent more lending and get more capital flowing through our communities as a result. Rather than the metaphorical patchwork of subsistence sharecropping into which we've been planting our economic future up until now, Senate Bill 889 provides a wide field for us to put down roots and build something that's truly in Oregon's long-term best interest. We will cultivate lasting jobs for this generation and the next. I'm looking forward to the work ahead, and I encourage this committee to pass this legislation with the appropriate amendments. I truly believe that it is the right step on the road to a saner, more productive economic plan for the state of Oregon. Thank you. Signed, Treasurer Ted Wheeler.
Ted, and perhaps James, congratulations on good metaphors like sowing our economic fields.
Very, very proud of that one.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the fellow committee members of the record, Alan Bates. I'm State Senator District 3, Southern Oregon. This bill has been brought forward for a lot of different reasons, but I'm going to address it from the point of view of Southern Oregon. We are going through, as we all know, a terrible recession, a recession which, quite frankly, I think has affected rural areas more than it has the Willamette Valley, although the Willamette Valley has obviously been hard hit, too. In areas like myself, the area that I live in, we have home vacancies, empty houses of 10 to 15 to 20% in some of our communities. We have business after business failing. We have an unemployment probably closer to 20% than the listed 12 or 13%. And we don't see things improving very quickly. When I talk to my small business people, they tell me I can no longer get the line of credit I used to run routinely for the last 25 years. I've been cut off from that. I'm closing my business. They can't get capitalization money to rebuild infrastructure, to deal with in the agriculture community the next year's crops. It's one issue after another. These are people who have had good credit in the past, continue to have good credit, but have had that credit cut off because capitalization is so difficult. They're used to working with their local banks. The local banks have more restrictions on them now and less capital available to them. What this bill tries to do is leverage state funds, which are in various funds across state, bring it in under one organization so the local bank can go to that organization and with them work out funding issues for our local and small businesses. It's vital to Southern Oregon that this bill be passed. It's important to us for economic recovery, which we hope will start soon in our areas in which we have frankly not seen yet. I think that Eastern Oregon and the coast are probably in similar situations, and I would expect that if you checked with your local business community in Portland and Eugene and in Salem, they are probably at some level facing the same kind of issues we are in Southern Oregon. So my remarks are going to be short. I've read the bill. I understand about three-fourths of it. I'm not going to admit that I own every single piece of it. I'm not a banker, but basically it does what we're asking you to do. Give us our local bank communities a chance to access state funds in a way that is responsible, but which gives a real boost to our local small businesses. And I'll be glad to take any questions as long as there's something I think I can have some possibility of answering.
It's never stopped you before.
Yeah, I know. And I've got myself in trouble that way.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. Senator George.
The Treasurer's Office. Are we talking about taking funds that are like in the PERS account and having them participate in this kind of banking structure?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill would not take money out of the pension plan for economic development purposes. We do have, however, a small carve-out from the pension plan that's run by the Oregon Investment Council called the Oregon Investment Fund, and those funds are geared towards local investment. And one of the purposes of this is to put a broader strategic framework over all of our economic development efforts. So even though it would probably be a fiduciary violation to actually take pension dollars and put them into an economic development program on its own, we do feel this provides an appropriate vehicle to coordinate the efforts of the Oregon Investment Council in this regard with the other economic development efforts elsewhere in the state.
So are we talking then, I mean, we're talking about the monies that the state treasurer manages for the state of Oregon. A large percentage of it's PERS, some of that's the unemployment trust fund, some of that's just the float that the state has. So to capitalize this lending authority, where do those dollars come from? What dollars are we putting at risk that would be managed outside of a typical fiduciary responsibility and put into this structure? So what funds are we putting at risk by adopting something like this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, under this bill, no funds would be put at any additional risk than they are now. I can't tell you that there's no risk because every fund has risk. There's no such thing as a no-risk place to keep your money. Even your mattress can get broken into. So, the bill does not change any of the existing statutory cyborgs on these funds. And a lot of these funds already exist as economic development resources, such as those that live at Business Oregon. Treasury runs lottery dollars through economic development programs through the Oregon Growth Account, for example. The problem that we've seen is that these are scattered among many different agencies and that there's no strategic framework that is asking them to basically march in the same direction or to really dovetail with any of the other economic development policies that we're working on elsewhere in the in state policy. So the central theme here with this bill in regards to your question, Senator George, is not so much to gather additional dollars out of the general fund or money that's being put to use elsewhere, but rather to first consolidate the dollars that we already have deployed in a way that makes more sense.
If I could, colleagues, I said we're going to wrap this up by 2 o'clock. We've got a lot of people to testify. So why don't we take one question from Senator Boquist, and then I think this will have some more discussion after the hearing
on
this.
The next group, and I'll just make a comment in the meantime.
Okay. Yeah, why don't we pull up the next group then. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your testimony. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Ty.
Could we bring up Dan Steffi, Mr. Vigesa again from the bank, and Jose Gonzalez.
And to comment, I mean, to Senator George's comment here, you know, we can either take our Libyan investments or our Iranian investments and put them back in Oregon. That's one option. The second option, though, is more to the tune of last session we had these go-rounds with the Oregon Investment Council, is this provides a framework from which them to then identify and utilize funds in the state of Oregon, not so much the dollars that are there. Senator Bates and I rarely agree on anything. We do agree on two things. One, this is a good idea in some form. I co-sponsored several other bills. And two, I'm at 21% on the U6 unemployment rate, and I'm in the Willamette Valley. So we got to do something different than what we're doing.
That's right. Thank you. And welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Shields and members of the committee. My name is Dan Steffi. I'm Senior Vice President of Development for Guardian Real Estate Services in Portland. We are celebrating our 40th year in the property management ownership and operation. We manage about 13,000 units of housing of all types in 7 states. In the last 10 years, we have produced or preserved 1,700 units of affordable housing across the state and across the region in places like Clatskanie, Ontario, Winston, Roseburg, Monmouth, McMinnville, Milwaukee, Portland, Gresham. I have a very simple message to a very complex problem here, and that is I want you to focus on the fact that affordable housing is a fundamental tool of economic development. If you don't have a place for your workforce to reside, you don't have a stable economy in your area. The reason I'm batting ahead of Malin here is because we have a specific project in the Dalles that I will get to. Over the last 10 years, when we've been producing those units that I mentioned, we've had very robust relationships with major lenders who today are telling us they won't go to places like the Dalles or Roseburg or Lincoln City because they think there's too high a risk there. And people like Malin, who run the community banks and understand the economy, are quite willing to come partner with us, but the parameters of the loans that we require to make these projects work don't fit within the capacity of the community banks. So something like the authority would in fact create a participation pool where the local community banks would have the opportunity to participate. The project in the Dalles is a 94-unit project. It's actually 60 units today. We're proposing to build another 34 units. Let me put that in context. 94 units of affordable housing in a community of 12,500 of the Dalles is the equivalent, statistically, of 4,000 units of affordable housing in a community like Portland with 500,000 population. So these are major issues for these communities. We are just now this week closing the financing on a portfolio of 9 transactions, 8 of which will be closed by the end of this week. Those 9 projects will produce, during the construction phase, 500 jobs that will be scattered around the state. Without the lenders there to participate with a very professional, conscientious and collaborative folks at Oregon Housing and Community Services, from which we get a lot of the companion resources, those projects won't go forward in places like Hermiston or Ontario or Roseburg. So we need that, that additional support to keep these things going. You've got a lot of people to talk at you today, so I'm going to shut up and let Malin go.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Malin Vigasa. Everybody knows me by Malin. I am the president and CEO of CenterPoint Community Bank, a fairly new bank. We've been open for approximately 3 years and have been very successful. The bank is locally owned, and we have full focus about the well-being of our community and the economic growth within the Columbia Gorge region. I have over 40 years of experience in banking, mostly with large banks, but more recently with community banks. I believe the Oregon Credit and Finance Authority will provide valuable tools to help community banks finance projects needed in our communities. This will be a win-win for Oregon communities and the state. Right now, large out-of-state banks have the vast majority of Oregon public funds. They also use their branches to gather deposits from our communities and ultimately use these funds to chase the best returns, which in downturns like we are currently having now, these funds are often used for corporate expansions overseas where jobs are made rather than keeping the funds and the jobs here. This proposal is a good first step in coordinating Oregon's funds to meet the financial needs of our communities. There's three most important aspects of this. The first is buying loan participations. Community banks primarily invest within their own communities, providing loans to local agriculture and business customers. Being a small bank, we have limitations on the size of the loans that we can make. We often have requests for loans much greater than our bank loan authority is. For example, the affordable housing project that Dan was just mentioning. We currently try to participate with other community banks. However, there is multiple practical restraints that make this process time-consuming and difficult to work with. A virtual state bank that provided loan participations, community banks could underwrite larger loans and then have the state bank participate in the remaining participations. Having standardized loan participation agreements would streamline the process and save time and legal costs for the community banks. This would really help community banks grow with their clients and increase competition for the funding process. The second item is the ability to sell loan participations to banks. Once a virtual state bank participates in a loan, they could hold this loan and earn the profit for the state, or they could sell the loan or a portion of the loan to other community banks to free up capacity for additional lending. Community banks are often out of sync with their deposits and loans. In some cycles, we're flush with deposits and we really need the loans. At other times, we have a great loan demand, but we don't have enough deposit to support it. The virtual state bank would help facilitate the process of us preventing from this whole fluctuation process. And the last item is consolidating and streamlining the economic development tools. With the virtual state bank proposal, the state of Oregon could consolidate various economic development tools such as loan guarantee programs, integrate buy-down programs, etc. From a banker's perspective, these programs have been very hard to keep track of and participate in. centralizing these tools and facilitating their implementation through community banks that have relationships with the local communities would help meet the real needs of the community and the state. I urge you to support the creation of the Virtual State Bank that will help fund agriculture and small business and affordable housing projects. It will strengthen our communities, which in turn will strengthen the state. I also urge you to keep in mind there's with this entity is important with a couple of things that should be emphasized. And that is that the banking seats on the advisory board should be limited to Oregon community banks that most benefit from the program. Large banks and even regional banks do not need this type of support in the same way. One of the best ways to clarify this is to limit the number of seats to Oregon banks which have at least 75% of their branches here local in Oregon. And the second aspect is because of the intent of this legislation is to increase the flow of credit to meet the needs of Oregon communities, it should be specified at a minimum that Virtual State Bank should have the ability to participate buying and selling as well as streamlining the economic development. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. One question from Senator George, and then we're going to jump in.
I'm trying to functionally understand how this would work. So in the way this structure would function is that you as a community bank would still be the issuer of the loan. They would simply come in and supply you additional capital, or would they buy out part of the loan to lower your risk level? So are they actually providing capital, or are you saying they would basically take on a second that would be subject to your first?
Senator, I can address this by maybe an example. If we had a $5 million loan request and our limit for our bank was $2 million, we could participate out that $3 million to the state. We would make the loan to the capacity that the bank is authorized to make, and then the remaining of that would be participated out to the virtual bank. The virtual bank could retain this, or they could sell it to other community banks, that full $3 million, or a portion of that $3 million, for the benefit of these other communities, banks. The benefit of all of this is that if we can't do that, that loan is not made, and the development for the loan is not done.
Check out who has the risk. Sounds like the state takes the risk. Okay,
so is the state taking a second, or is the state taking the first?
They take first ownership of a piece of the loan.
So you guys... under your example, you have a $2 million at risk. The state has a $3 million at risk. Let's say, for instance, the project fails. Who gets paid back?
It would be proportioned out.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Good question. Mr. Gonzalez, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Senator Chip Shields and distinguished committee members. My name is Jose Gonzalez, and I'm president of Tucasa Real Estate. We've been in the Salem area for 18 years. I've been there 15 of them. 2005, I was given the opportunity to buy out the majority share, and I've enjoyed the ride ever since. We haven't lost anybody, you know, so we're keeping busy. What's interesting for me to see is, being business that long, we're actually able to not only help some of these clients on their second or third purchases, we've helped their children, and most excitingly is these people become business owners. So because of that, we've had to create a whole new resource, a team of professionals to support them. We've created the Latino Business Alliance, which is a all-volunteer business-to-business support network. And over the last 15 years, I've dealt with every bank. I understand the underwriting criteria. And I think a lot of it has to do with the way they're, you know, the underwriting process, the way they value their assets. You know, 30% of all first-time new business owners use home equity.
Mr. Chair, if you'd speak farther away from the mic, they're very sensitive. They pick up. You're garbling your voice when you get really close.
Does this sound good right here?
Yep.
Okay. Should I start over? No, just kidding. You know, over the last 15 years, I've dealt with every bank. I am very familiar with their underwriting standards and the way they value assets. You know, one of the issues is house values. A lot of these small business owners have at one time or currently or in the future business owners have used their home equity to fund their startup business. And, you know, currently we're having a big issue on that end. So we're trying to, as we're trying to help these business owners get off the ground, take their business to the next level, we try to layer loans, whether it's city grants, urban renewal money. I mean, and at the end of the day, the small business owner is tired. They have no time. They get frustrated. And so we need something simpler. A good example is a local construction contractor, very strong assets, income, and credit. And this fellow had a school contract to do some work on a school, and he could only get a six-month term loan from a big bank. And by the time it was all said and done, it was 8 months. And for 2 months, he had to carry $700,000 of these costs and from his own pocket. And he told me this is going to be the last time he's going to go after one of these projects. He simply can't afford it. And I guess the good news here is that of all the businesses that I've seen, the ones that are still standing, it seems that most of them are ready to expand on a new idea. They're here. They're still here for a reason because they truly are passionate about their business, and they just sometimes need access, better access to credit to support that new idea, that new area. And that's why I feel State Bank, in my opinion, is a great partner for not only small businesses, the taxpayer, and the local business and local banking community.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony, gentlemen. We'll bring up Sarah Brown, Kendrick Kim Barankis, Christine Chin Ryan, please.
Chair Shields and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Brown, and my husband and I run a farm just outside of Portland, Oregon. We've been there for the past going on 4 years, and during that time, we've been actively pursuing lending, and we've been looking for a farm to purchase. We've been renting, and it's been incredibly difficult, and we are hypothetically, we're eligible for the different farm loans that are available, but there have been major inconsistencies in how those eligibility requirements are interpreted, and we're very, very qualified borrowers. We have very steady, good income. We have quite a bit of savings. I have a degree in sustainable agriculture. We've managed farms. We've filed Schedule Fs, and we've shown that our income is growing. And still, we've had a very, very difficult time getting a loan. So with the Farm Service Agency, they have beginning farmer loan programs, but as I mentioned, they're inconsistent in how the eligibility requirements are interpreted, and they also, they don't fit all farmers. I think ideally they would, but it's very much up to the loan officer to determine who they work with, and we do fresh market vegetables, and we do it primarily through CSAs or community supported agriculture, and so there's not enough data to support that we actually and our peers who are doing these very similar operations can actually be grossing between $20,000 and $40,000 an acre. But that is not typical of most agriculture in the state or the nation. And so the banks that are loaning on agriculture are having a hard time. They perceive it as a risk, and they don't see how that's possible, but it is, and I think that the State Bank has the potential to help different size farmers that fit into maybe different categories that aren't necessarily hobby farmers, but are doing it on a different scale or with specialty crops. So that's one example with FSA. With private lenders, if you go to them and you say that you want financing for a farm, they pretty much say they can't help you. They ask you, we've had to say that we're not going to farm to get lending because they won't finance farms, and so they ask you to actually sign a document that says you have no intention of farming because it's considered so risky. And actually, we made an offer on a place this week, but it looks like the underwriters, because it's 70 acres, they want to value it at over $200,000 less than the appraised value because, again, it's a farm. And so I think this is a very, very, this has the potential to fill a gap in the agricultural lending in Oregon.
Great. Thank you very much. Next.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields and members of the committee. My name is Kendra Kimbaraskis, and I am here today representing or wearing two hats. First off, my husband and I, we own a small farm in Colton, which is in Clackamas County. We raise a variety of vegetables. We have laying hens, meat birds, dairy goats, hogs, and a bunch of other critters on the property. And we actually are one of the farmers that went to refinance, and we had to sign a document to our lender promising that we were just a hobby farm and we have no intention of having any of making money or making a profit, having a career as farmers. And so the second hat that I'm wearing, I'm president of Friends of Family Farmers. Friends of Family Farmers is the state's largest advocacy organization for family-scale agriculture in Oregon. I don't really have too much to add to what Ms. Brown said other than that hearing from our members from all over the state of Oregon that this is, that Sarah's story is not an anomaly, that this is something that's happening in our rural communities across the state and that we really do need to find a solution so that we can ensure that not only will Oregon's family-scale agriculture remain viable in the state, but that new and beginning farmers have the opportunity to access capital so that they can access land. And one thing that wasn't mentioned that I will add is that it's important to note that the average age of Oregon's farmers is 58 years old, and that the people that are coming on the land are not necessarily coming from farm families. These are people that are coming from other areas, and so they don't necessarily have the land or the capital or in the family to start their farm business. So they really are relying on lending and banking institutions to get to that next step. Thank you for this opportunity.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Christine.
Thank you, Chair Shields and members of the committee. For the record, I am Christine Chen Ryan, founder and president of Synergy Consulting, Inc. Synergy Consulting, Inc. is a small business technology firm providing customized software development for 23 years. I also serve as chair of the Oregon Small Business for Responsible Leadership and served as chair of the Governor's Small Business Council. First, I'd like to share with you some small business statistics. Employers with fewer than 100 employees in Oregon account for 51.3% of private sector employment and 94.4% of the 105,940 firms. They account for 43.7% of the state's payroll, generate 51.3% of the state's jobs, and paid $5.6 billion in wages in the first quarter of 2010. The source is the Oregon Employment Department first quarter 2010 businesses covered by unemployment insurance. I would also like to share a story of a small business owner in my hometown of Sandy. Mark Fritch, owner of Mark Fritch Log Homes, has been in business for 28 years. He's currently trying to secure funding to purchase a new work site. After 21 years at the same location, he learned that the owner had sold the property. The new owner is offering half the space that Mark had prior to sale at double the rent. He can't realistically work in that small space and at double the rent. He's looking to buy a piece of property and will need to come up with about $50,000 for a down payment. He has been confirmed by Clackamas County Economic Development as eligible to receive $50,000 in matching funds if he can find a small local bank that will lend him the loan. Things are in process but are currently moving at a glacial pace. Senate Bill 889 addresses Oregon businesses and merges the economic development functions of existing agencies into a single administrative function. However, Senate Bill 889 should also address Oregon's small businesses as the primary beneficiaries of this bill, as well as merging the existing agencies' economic development functions into one administrative function. The original efforts to create an Oregon State Bank were to be targeted to us small businesses hit hardest by this economic downturn. Commercial financial and banking institutions have severely restricted or completely halted small business loan and credit lines accounts regardless of previous or current credit worthiness. In light of these facts, I would like to request to include in House Bill 889 an Oregon Small Business Loan Participation Fund with a fixed amount of $30 million targeted exclusively towards qualified small businesses. Small businesses are defined in ORS 285B.123-2. This amendment would ensure that small businesses have access to capital without competing with medium and large businesses. The Oregon Small Business Loan Participation Fund will give small businesses the funds needed to continue to spur economic development and growth job to get us out of this recession. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Christine. Appreciate your testimony. We'll wait till one of the chief proponents comes up. Thank you very much for your testimony. We bring up Jared Gardner, Barbara Dudley, and Linda Bergen.
Hi.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Shields and Senators. My name is Barbara Dudley. I am the co-chair of the Oregon Working Families Party. The Working Families Party first started talking about an Oregon State Bank over 2 years ago as we began to see the full impact of this recession on businesses and jobs in Oregon. This recession, we must remember, began when the Wall Street banks and other financial institutions took advantage of the climate of deregulation to manipulate mortgages, savings, and pensions of hardworking Americans and brought our economy to its knees. And then those financial institutions that were about to go belly up came to those same hardworking Americans for a $700 billion bailout. As a result of that bailout, the financial institutions that were deemed too big to fail have seen a recovery. Their profits, their salaries, their bonuses have fully recovered, and the rest of us have had to get used to a very brutal new term, jobless recovery. Main Street businesses can't get credit, working people can't get jobs. The too big to fail banks aren't lending, and the community banks, which are the financial backbone of Main Street, are under ever tighter regulation and capital restriction. The state bank we originally proposed was modeled on the Bank of North Dakota, a very successful, financially and politically successful, 90-year-plus institution. It's a bank. It's run by bankers. It's designed to strengthen the local banking sector, which today in North Dakota consists of over 90 thriving community banks, supporting a state economy which has not had a recession, not in job loss, not in credit contraction, not in a state budget deficit, not at all. And the Bank of North Dakota returns a healthy profit to its owners, who are the people of the state of North Dakota. Over the past 10 years, it has returned $350 million to the state's general funds. Last May, we hosted a video conference with the president of the Bank of North Dakota and some of the North Dakota community bankers and some of the Oregon's community bankers to learn how the Bank of North Dakota functioned in conjunction with their local banking sector. Impressed with their model and their experience, we began to fashion similar legislation for Oregon. As soon as we started to talk about a state bank for Oregon, we found two things. The people of this state were overwhelmingly supportive. Business owners, family farmers, people out of work, people struggling to hold on to jobs. The people in this room and in the overflow room are from all over this state. They are concerned about the state of our economy and our joblessness. They want this bill to pass. But the Oregon Bankers Association from the very beginning opposed this whole idea, despite the clear intention of the legislation to create not a retail bank, but a banker's bank, run by bankers based on the most prudent banking practices designed to strengthen and in no way compete with the community banking sector. We understood that to rebuild our state's economy, we needed a robust community banking sector and credit unions, and from the beginning, the legislation was designed to further that end. The OBA, however, represents Wall Street banks as well as community banks and was not interested in legislation designed to provide Oregon with independence from Wall Street. There's plenty of credit out there, just no credit-worthy borrowers, the OBA argued. The state and presumably community banks are not competent to make sound loans. They will put your money at risk. That was from the institutions that came up with subprime mortgages, with credit default swaps, and collateralized debt obligations. It's a socialist plot, they whispered. This from the folks who had just received $700 billion in public funds to bail them out of a private mess. The OBA has considerable influence in this building and in this state, and slowly this legislation has been whittled down. In fact, in the last round of negotiations, the OBA actually lobbied to put Wall Street bankers on the advisory council of this institution instead of bankers from locally owned banks that we had first proposed. And the OBA wanted to strike the language authorizing participation loans with community banks. If you want to see what a real Oregon State Bank would look like, take a look at HB 2972, which is also, I believe, still in the Rules Committee over in the House. That was introduced by Representative Jensen from Hermiston. The version you have before you is not a bank, but a finance and credit board, or what the treasurer has been calling a virtual state bank. And no, we are not entirely happy with it, but we do hope it will provide the experience necessary to show the legislature, and more importantly, the people of this state, what more might be possible. And for that reason, we urge its passage. We all have an obligation to address the fact that we still have over 10% unemployment in Oregon. For all the talk in this town of jobs, 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 very little has been done to address that crisis. And it truly is a crisis for the working families of this state. Passage of this bill would be a concrete step toward creating jobs, a step that your constituents would support and applaud. So I urge you to have the foresight and the courage to take up this challenge. Thank you.
Chair Shields and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. I would like to point out that over the last 15 years of deregulation, the Wall Street...
Read your name.
Oh, for the record, my name is Jared Gardner, and I'm with the Coalition Oregonians for State Bank. I would like to point out that over the last 15 years of deregulation, we've seen in Oregon the deposits of Oregonians go from 35% deposited in Wall Street banks to now 60%, just over 60%. We're losing our community banks and their vitality in the state. I think that is a problem. We've heard some testimony. Anytime a financial institution pulls a line of credit or otherwise does not renew lending for a viable, creditworthy business, that business will suffer. And that's what we've seen in this credit downturn. The state bank is designed to support the community banks so that they can continue to serve that flow of credit to creditworthy and viable businesses. We've heard the local stories, but even Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, quoted last week, says that the playing field is not level, that community banks are doing the lending in our communities. The big banks have brought some value to the system through their automated underwriting systems, but those don't work in places like the Dalles where there aren't comparable projects. And we need, especially for our smaller communities, we need local decision makers, not somebody 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 miles away to try to understand what's going on in these communities. Senator George, you were asking about risk. I think that's a very important thing to be focused on. We're talking about credit-worthy, viable businesses. We should also be looking at the mechanism being able to buy loans that are great in our communities. We have VA, Veterans Affairs loans. We have FHA, Federal Housing Authority loans, and Small Business Authority loans that are guaranteed by the federal government that currently are being sold out of state. The Bank of North Dakota, as well as, I believe, Idaho, have been exceptional at capturing those low-risk loans and generating revenue for the state. That would allow community banks to participate more in those. Right now, when they sell a loan, it tends to be bought by a big Wall Street bank that then markets those clients for depository services, credit cards, and eventual refinances. So we're not just talking about downturns here. When the economy picks up, there will be another type of lending crunch, as community banks are not able to expand and ramp up their lending as fast as big banks. They will be hit with their concentration caps and potentially their loan size caps. So having a state institution to help them manage their growth through loan participations and be able to buy and sell loans, as Malin was talking about, would help them manage their health and growth. I would also like to point out for the record that I believe you all have testimony from DEMOS, a group that has been a nonpartisan group doing research on the state bank concept, as well as Rex Brittle, president and CEO of MBank, who talks a little bit more about the specific differences between community banks and big banks. Thank you for your time.
Perfect. Thank you.
Chair Senator Shields and Vice Chair Senator George, and all the members of the Senate Government Committee. I'm Linda Bergen, President of SEIU 503, Oregon Public Employees Union. We represent over 45,000 members who provide critical public services. And we know that it takes a vital state economy with a stable workforce to fund the services that Oregonians believe in. The economic crisis has taken a heavy toll in Oregon. Families have lost jobs, savings, quality of life, and in many cases, even their homes. Across the state, neighborhoods are reeling from unemployment coupled with devastating cuts to vital services like health care, education, and public safety. And lending to small businesses has plummeted. Senate Bill 889 would create the framework for a coordinated economic development approach to jump-starting our state's economy. In particular, the work of the authority could direct funds and identify needs of capital for Oregon's small businesses and family farms. Between 2007 and 2010, the number of small business loans in Oregon declined by 54%, or 20 million business loans. This has had a devastating impact on unemployment. Oregon has lost nearly 150,000 jobs in this recession. According to Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, small businesses employ roughly one-half of all Americans and account for about 60% of gross job creation. And then according to a National Small Business Association report, 56% of small businesses that have problems finding available credit reported having to lay off employees as a result. We also believe that a future discussion about keeping taxpayer dollars in Oregon would be valuable. Our state could benefit from recirculating our resources back into our communities and local businesses, capturing the interest generated from revenue and reinvesting the income into schools, health care, and public safety. We believe this bill is a great first step. The authority would be an important tool in helping Oregon's economy recover and grow. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Barbara.
Barbara,
I really appreciate the amount of time you spent with me going through this, but I'm still getting to this, trying to figure out the risk level that we're exposing state funds to. So far, the testimony and some of the emails I've gotten on this are from people who have what in essence are subprime loans, meaning they don't have enough down payment, they don't have enough lending history, they don't have enough. And so if the goal of it is to, in essence, create support to the community banks so that they can actually make lending decisions to people who are deserving, that's one thing. If what we're doing is trying to take state funds to expand credit to people who are low credit risk or further credit risk, like some of the people that I feel like are advocating for the bill, there's an expectation that, in essence, people who may not be able to get credit through the current system will get it through this system, and so I think there's a false expectation. I just want to make sure that as we go forward, we have to have some really tight sideboards not to put the people's money at risk in this structure. So can you explain a little bit? I don't want to go down the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac pathway where we said, oh, everybody should own a home, right. So we basically opened up the floodgates and all that capital, in essence, was lost. Talk to me what the sideboards are here, that we're not just giving loans to people because they have a great story.
I'm also going to ask Jared to chime in on that, but the question is an important one, and it is why we promoted a state bank to start with as opposed to this Finance and Credit Authority. We have insisted that the language stay in this legislation that has a banker running this, and that the lending, the straight market lending that is done in participation with community banks and credit unions so that they will have have skin in the game, and they will have to be doing the same vetting of borrowers that they currently do. It will just make it possible for them to be more lending. There's also the economic development side of this. There are many funds that the state already has set aside money for certain funds that will be at lower interest rates or a longer payback period, whatever it might be, that would make it more possible for people who might not meet the market-based criteria to get a loan with less burden. Those funds are already set aside. They're not used as well as they should be used by the state, and for the most part, they're not used in conjunction with community bankers who could be vetting good loans on a local level and maybe be willing to put some money in if the state guarantees some or whatever it might do. But you have to separate out the market-based lending and the economic development programs.
Okay.
But I would...
Jared, do you want to add Could you come by my office? But I don't want to take time.
Yes,
to
we'd testimony. Be happy to.
This is my main issue. My main objection right now is this risk capital situation of the public's money, because we don't have a lot of it. So
we agree wholeheartedly. I mean, whatever sideboards you want to put on this that would protect against risk, including not giving it to Goldman Sachs, I might say, I would be more than happy to support.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Could we please bring up Linda Nicholson, Jim Clark, and Anna Marie Mailer?
And just for the record, Mr. Chair, I'm not as caustic about this as Senator Georgia. I think we should move forward immediately.
Could you say that again to the mic?
I perfectly think we should move forward. I mean, we're in a position right now where the largest risk we have is the failure of Congress.
It doesn't look like Navarro. There's Linda somewhere.
Kevin Ronis.
Linda Nicholson?
Navarro.
Oh, okay. All right, yeah. Welcome,
I'm with
Linda.
These guys, so I
assume. Welcome, committee.
Thank you.
I didn't think you got married again.
15 years ago. Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee. I'm Linda Navarro, President and CEO of the Oregon Bankers Association, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I am joined by two Oregon community bankers. One is chair of the Oregon Bankers Association this year, and one is chair of the Independent Community Banks of Oregon this for 2 years. And I am President and CEO of both organizations. We represent Oregon's banks that are FDIC-insured depository institutions in this state that take deposits and make loans and have branches and people working in this state. And that's what we think differentiates us from some of the investment banks and other companies that have been referred to as banks, particularly in the last few years. We're here today to talk about this issue, and I appreciate you giving us the opportunity to represent Oregon Bankers Association's own views on this bill. Previous testimony indicated our position was outright oppose any such negotiations from the start, and that, in fact, isn't true. We have from the start and for the last 70 years, according to our records, opposed the creation of a North Dakota-style state-owned bank. And back a couple years ago when we were invited to participate in the video conference that was mentioned, I attended as well as a number of bankers, and it was largely modeled after the North Dakota-style state-owned bank. North Dakota in 1919 and Oregon in 2011 are very different. And for a variety of reasons that I won't necessarily go into today, because that's not the legislation before you, we do continue to oppose the creation of a North Dakota-style state-owned bank. We've heard several issues and problems raised today, and we've heard them before, and some are very, very real problems. But where we've been on this issue from the start is that you need a very real solution to a very real problem, and they have to match up. And one of the things that hasn't really been raised today is in Oregon, we have a pretty robust economic development department called Business Oregon, which we believe is already a structure and a vehicle for creating and enhancing lending programs that are in partnership with Oregon's banks. Community banks in particular are participants in those programs. So the handout I gave you lists the various state programs that currently exist. The very first one on that list, which is right off the Business Oregon website, is a direct lending program to companies that can't meet perhaps some of the traditional underwriting criteria of banks. Most of the rest of them, like the Credit Enhancement Fund, the Capital Access Program, those are loan programs in partnership with Oregon's banks. So we do support that kind of lending program, and if there's a desire to create a new type of lending program, we think Business Oregon is a good vehicle under which to do that. They have a Oregon Economic Development Commission that they report to. They have a loan committee on which three community bankers, one from People's Bank of Commerce in Medford, one from Bank of Eastern Oregon, headquartered in Heppner, Oregon, and one from Citizens Bank, headquartered in Corvallis, Oregon, already serve. They serve on the Loan Advisory Committee of Business Oregon. And they, the department reports up to the commission. So we believe that the credit structure that's been discussed in the legislation before you is, well, there's a structure already in place at the state, a board, a commission, an advisory committee that can serve that function. In more recent conversations with the Treasury, with Representative Barnhart and others, it became clear that the piece that they're concerned about has to do with how various pots of money, whether that's the Oregon Investment Fund or other types of agency resources, how those are managed and invested. And so what we have communicated in recent meetings is that if there's a desire in the Treasury to have another board that would focus on managing those investments, that side of the equation, then that's, you know, certainly their prerogative to recommend that, and it really doesn't have to do with the credit side in terms of day-to-day management. It can, however, provide some added resources to support Business Oregon programs, and that could be a good thing. So we've been very open to the idea of a program or a board of some kind with a very well-defined advisory committee, including predominantly financial institutions from our point of view, if you're going to work in partnership with them, that would be designed to work on those investment approaches. So really, there's the investment side and the credit side in our point of view, and we need to look at what is the unmet need in the state. And if that is in managing state investments and pots of funds, which aren't entirely clear to me what they are, but the Oregon Investment Fund is one that was mentioned, then, you know, we've been very open to considering that, and there's some amendments we've been working on with Representative Barnhart and the Treasury in that regard. So with that, I'll stop here and open it up to the bankers.
Chair Shields and committee, thanks for inviting us here today. My name is Anne Marie Malam, and I am the chair of the Oregon Bankers Association this year. We represent all the banks, the FDIC depository banks, and the board of the OBA unanimously voted in opposition of a virtual bank and this bill as it was originally designed. Most of our directors on that board are CEOs of community banks. We do represent all the banks, but community banks are the biggest group. Myself, I'm the president and CEO of Summit Bank in Eugene, Oregon, and we are considered a pretty small bank. We're $100 million in assets, and I have 26 employees, so I am a small business. And our whole existence is to make loans to small businesses. And we come to work every day to make loans to businesses, and we are trying like heck to make loans. And I also want to applaud all of you for all the work that you do to try and help Oregon's economy. And I certainly personally really like the blue sticker that says invest in Oregon, not Wall Street. And I also believe that if this bill was truly going to help community banks, the Oregon Bankers Association will get behind it. We are working with making amendments. There is a need to provide that unified framework that was in the treasurer's testimony, but it also his testimony also included appropriate amendments. And we do agree that there are a lot of buried programs in the state that if we could get access to and work with more easily, if they are more user-friendly, that that's a very good idea. The participation issue that you've heard about, actually banks participate with each other all the time. We've heard about two issues today. One is that community banks can't make big enough loans, and the other is that really it's the small borrowers that aren't getting an attention. In terms of big enough loans, even my bank has led a $10 million loan participation where we found other community banks to take parts of that loan. And in fact, our portfolio of loans is about $100 million, and we've sold an additional 30 in participations to other banks. So I think we can handle participations to do bigger loans when they do make sense. The other thing is for the smaller loans, most community banks in Oregon do have cash right now. There is lots of cash, and believe me, we're not hoarding it. We want to make loans. So to make the smaller loans, we are capable of doing it, and we're trying to do it. And what we don't want to do is make the loan that throws the customer clearly into bankruptcy. We're trying to do it prudently and so that our customers will not go into bankruptcy, will grow, and will continue to be successful. And I personally do have an issue with the idea that we're going to take money that we don't have in Oregon and somehow put it more at risk than what bankers are doing right now. If you're going to make loans that are riskier than the ones I'm making, I worry about that. But I'm going to leave it there and let Jim Clark continue. And again, thanks for letting us be here today and describe where we think we are on this one.
Thank you, Henry. Chair Shields and Vice Chair Senator George. I'm Jim Clark. I'm the President and Chief Executive Officer for Oregon Pacific Bank in Florence, Oregon. We, too, would qualify as that small business out there in the community, in rural coastal Oregon community, trying to help grow the bank's communities in the three areas that we primarily serve. Today I'm here as the chair of the Independent Community Banks of Oregon, and as we've reviewed the bill as presented, I guess to highlight that maybe to Senator George's earlier questions, off page one of the bill, line 13, enhance the availability of venture capital for Oregon businesses. And with that, I guess I would begin to say that there's a difference between sound and prudent banking, as your bank exam teams would come to us with, and venture capital investing. Safe and sound banking practices would identify that there's established cash flows, secondary source repayment, probability of loss fairly low. Venture capital lending is something that is done by a completely different group of people. It's done with a far higher expectation of loss and hopefully a substantially higher rate of return if it turns out. But if the state's dollars were going to be put at risk, a venture capital operation would definitely have a higher event of default that would come with it. When it comes to what it takes to get community banks to lend more, you know, one of the comments I'd heard earlier was that the money center banks are pulling the deposit dollars out of Oregon. And technically, I would say that's true. You can look at the FDIC reports to support that. The challenge to that is that I just ask all the people of Oregon, bank with your community bank. They've made a choice to take their deposit dollars to a national bank that has the opportunity to take them out of market. That's a choice that everyone in the room with a blue sticker or not has a choice of where they choose to put their dollars on deposit. For capital is at risk. And capital for a bank is that equity number over on one side. If we want to make more loans, we need to increase the capital. That can either be done by, say, government providing us with truly a capital injection of some point, probably not a good idea, or better yet, the capital enhancement programs already underway by Business Oregon that are in place, that have established programs, that have risk profiles and loan committees that they already have set up, that would allow us to make loans that would actually require less of our capital to be identified or subjugated to a particular loan. Liquidity is another issue. We greatly appreciate the Treasurer's Office recently reducing the amount of pledged securities from 100% of deposits down to 75%. So it does begin to make it a little more advantageous for a bank to want to get deposits from a government entity. But for a bank with a lower credit risk profile, and that will define that by the state banking regulators or by the Treasurer's Office, the ability to bring that below 75% is something we could look at for Oregon banks. Okay, now you've helped liquidity, now you've helped capital. Probably another area within lending in Oregon that is a challenge that you've heard from people up here earlier is real estate lending. And whether it's commercial real estate lending, whether it's residential lending, there are portfolio limits that each bank would want to have. Those were recently, in 2006, those were dictated by federal banking regulators as a guidance. That guidance kind of quietly became a rule through enforcement actions. But that's what's driving the behavior of the banks to limit their portfolio exposure to commercial real estate. Those loans on buildings, jobs, and lands, those loans on concentrations on farm lending, can be driven by that commercial real estate investment. The examples of signing a document that says you won't farm on property, that's another challenge of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. Not an idea that Oregon banks came up with as a way to reduce what we can lend. We make money by lending. When we make money, we can employ more people and improve our infrastructure in Oregon. Our goal is to be viable.
Thank you. Linda, how many of your members have cease and desist orders?
Chair Shields, I'm taking a guess, so it's an estimate. It's around 7 that have public enforcement orders right now, I believe.
Out of 35?
There are 32 banks headquartered in the state of Oregon, 29 are state chartered, and there are 50 traditional banks that do business in Oregon. Some are headquartered, for example, in Washington or Idaho and have branches.
Great, thank you. We'll have time for one more question. Unfortunately, it's that time of the session where we're going to have to go on to our other bills, but I do appreciate. Actually, we'll do one person who came over 100 miles, David Bean. He can testify. Senator George.
Real quick, though, I want to get back to this issue. I get the sense that the proponents of this bill are basically trying to use state capital that we have in the state treasury as an additional asset for our community banks to have, in essence, to leverage lending. And it's almost, as I get their discussion outside of this framework of how this bill is drafted, in essence, they're looking for a, sort of a state SBA program, using state dollars, in essence, to assist you all in making loans to Main Street. Can you see any framework upon where we can take their goal and put it into place using state treasury reserves?
Well, Senator George,
I'll just
very briefly say that the SBA programs are loan guarantee programs. That is what is on that list that I provided to you, what Business Oregon does. So if there's a way to take additional state resources, as I said, the investment side of the equation, and funnel those into programs that are managed through Business Oregon today, in other words, enhance the funding of those programs, or even potentially come before this body with an actual structure of a new loan program. Just in 2009, that direct lending program at the top of the list I gave you was just created. And we were supportive of that legislation because we understood the framework around it and how it would fit with banking in this state. But this is a pretty vague concept with no real pro forma, so it's hard to get our arms around what exactly is being suggested. Thank you.
Thanks. I appreciate it. And I apologize that we've got so many of the bills.
Mr. Chair, if the next person is coming forward, may I ask if Business Oregon is here or do they have a position on the bill? Do you know if they signed in and
They didn't sign in. I don't know if anyone is in the room.
All right, thank you.
Could also bring up Andrea Mulberry, who's came from 270 miles, and David Bean. And unfortunately, these will be our last testimony. And if you could do us a favor and try to keep it as concise as humanly possible. But I do appreciate that you've come all this way.
Chair Shields and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Andrea Malmberg. I am a cattle rancher in Union, Oregon, and I'm a member of Oregon Rural Action and the chair of the Oregon Grows Partnership. I am here today to speak in support of the creation of Oregon, of an Oregon Bank Senate Bill 889. I know firsthand that this is desperately needed, and I think that I can address something a little different, Senator George, and some of your concerns. Recently, my husband and I attempted to refinance, as we thought that our assets, good credit, profitable agriculture enterprises, and predictable consulting income, we should be able to benefit from today's lower interest rates and expand our business and create more wealth in our community. We spent several hundred dollars for an appraisal and underwriters' needs for consultations with our attorney and accountant as they tried to attempted to wrap their head around our business of cattle ranching and consulting with other in agriculture to become more profitable. After a good hour of signing a stack of papers, we were notified several days later at the 11th hour that we failed to qualify because we did not have salaried jobs. Let me reiterate, we did not get a job-creating loan because we didn't have jobs. We are business owners. This denial of credit had nothing to do with sound financial policy, but instead a clear sign that we have been caught up in the broken global financial system. We need lending institutions that understand the diverse nature of Oregon agriculture and the financial needs and contributions that we provide for the state. An Oregon State Bank that has Oregon's people's interests at its core will be a step in the right direction in building a vibrant state economy amidst the broken global financial system. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. My name is David Bean, and I wrote a thesis on the monetary system in 1978, which was in the midst of the Nixon stagflation. Might be before your time, but the economy was very much like this at that point on a tamer level.
That was your second goal. Mr. Chair, I was in the legislature in 1978. Uh-huh.
And I forgot to say... Chair Shields and members. I went to the. I want to start at the beginning. My folks spent $5,000 for their house in 1945, and you remember.
Yeah.
And. And there were, I think, about 150 million people in the United States. And now we have 310 million, and houses cost quite a bit more. Where'd that money come from? That's a lot of money that was generated. Where'd it come from? It came from a combination of our work and the banks. The banks created that money. That money wasn't there. It couldn't handle all the extra 150 million people that have come aboard. So what I'm saying about this banking proposal is that it needs to create money here where the work is done in Oregon. And it's not just a matter of pushing it around. Banks create it. And who has got the benefit and all the interest from creating the money since then? It's the money center banks on the island of Manhattan. So if we can get a portion of that here, and not only does it save us a lot of banking fees, it generates the wealth that we create from our jobs.
Thank you for your testimony. Well, we're going to have to move on.
Okay.
Thank you very much. All right. I appreciate everybody that came. I wish I could have given everybody a chance to speak. We have to clear the room, though, at about 5 minutes to three, so we've got to move on to the other bills. But feel free to stick around. We've got some more fireworks coming up. So.
What?
Mr. Chair, are we going to get at some point Oregon Business over here in the next 2 weeks?
Yeah, it'd be here, good to hear from Business Oregon.
Because they're not failing because of their own fault. We put restrictions on them.
I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 889. If you all could please keep your voices down as you're exiting the room. And I will open a public hearing on 490. Could you all please keep your voices down while you're exiting the room? Patrick, you want to tee us up where we are?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 490, we heard that for the previous two meetings on the 23rd and the 28th. Is the measure that requires utilities providing utility services to notify residents, residential tenants of possible termination. We have the -3 amendment still, and we have some testimony that we're hoping to get through today.
Okay. And if we can try to keep the testimony as brief as possible, get on the record what you need to. Let's start with Jeff Bissonnette, John Papenik, and David Barenberg. Welcome, committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette. I represent the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We represent residential ratepayers of regulated utilities. Here today to speak in favor of Senate Bill 490. Basically, in our view, this is an effort to try and establish some fairness and equity across the state, no matter where utility customer or where a tenant may live in the state in IOU or investor-owned utility territory or consumer-owned utility territory, that folks have sort of a basic expectation of the notice they might get if, unbeknownst to them, their landlord is running into difficulties. During the discussions on this bill, we started to look at a lot of the rules that exist for investor-owned utilities, and it started to raise a lot of interesting questions, not only about the issues of tenants and their notifications, but just about notifications across the board. And I have a very high level of confidence that, you know, if requested, and Cubbon does intend to be part of a request to the PUC to open some sort of docket to look at this issue. And I think that that is going to be an issue, you know, raise a lot of interesting information. And I think that if we need to make rule changes, we can do that. And if there's changes we need in statute, we can come back and ask for that. So that is, you know, for the customers that we represent in investor-owned utility service territory, you know, we're looking at taking that approach. However, I do think that at the heart of this bill is an issue of fairness and making sure that, again, no matter where a tenant lives and if they find themselves in trouble and in danger of getting their utility shut off through no fault of their own, I think that, again, there ought to be a basic expectation of how they're going to be treated. With that, I will finish and be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. Seeing none, let's move on to John Papenik and David Barenberg.
I don't think David... I think he's in another hearing right now.
Okay.
So.
How about Tom O'Connor? Is Tom O'Connor here? All right. Why don't you jump on it?
Chair Shields and the members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to discuss this with you. I'm with the City of Portland and the Portland Water Bureau, and for the most part, we have no qualms with this bill whatsoever. The City of Portland has about 185,000 water and sewer accounts. We have commercial, multifamily, and single-family accounts. Of those 185,000 accounts, approximately 160,000 are single-family accounts, and that's kind of where we have our concerns about this particular bill. Our practices today, as far as collections, is we seek to accommodate tenants as well as all the ratepayers within the city of Portland. Our goal is not to shut off the water service. Our goal is to keep and maintain the water service, whether you be a tenant or an owner or whatever, to try and find a way for those customers to continue to have the water service, but to make sure that they pay for the services that have been provided, simply because unpaid services result in higher rates for all customers that are out there. Multifamily properties in Portland, they are the responsibility for the owner. And so we bill the owners of those properties and expect payments from them. In the rare circumstance where we get to a point where we're near shut off because they haven't paid it, the city of Portland goes out and actually posts on doors 14 days in advance notification to each of the tenants, letting them know that this is going to happen. Our goal for that is hopefully that will create some sort of a fire and create payment to come in and stop that from occurring. To my knowledge, we've shut off one multifamily property, a fourplex, in at least the last 10 years, the 10 years that I've been with the Bureau. And the water then was restored very quickly when that actually occurred. Single-family properties, however, are the responsibility of the user of the service. And we at the city don't know if the user who is there is actually the owner of the property or if they're a tenant. There's no way for us to know that. This bill, as it's written right now, it presumes that you're a tenant if the mailing address does not match the service address. And of our 160,000 accounts, we have 16,000 single-family properties that have addresses that do not match the service address. The vast majority of these customers are customers that have them sent to post office boxes or their office address, or perhaps they have them sent to mom or dad who pay the bill, or perhaps even, like in my situation, it might be bills going to me so that I pay for my elderly parents or somebody else that they have some sort of control over that needs some sort of help. It's a convenience issue that is what primarily is there.
Could I get you to summarize your statements and then we'll
Okay. have to move on. Our concern is basically the notification on the single family properties. It will raise rates is what will happen there. We do notify all single family properties right now, 3 business days in advance of any shutoff. We like to keep that as close as possible to keep rates lower because a visit costs money to do that. And so that's really where our primary concern is with this bill, is just extending this notification period out even further. That's our major concern. We would like you to look at that aspect of it and see if there can be an accommodation made there.
Thank you for your testimony. We're going to have to go to 2 minutes, and those of you who are here to testify in opposition, if you could assess whether or not it really needs to be in public or whether or not written testimony might also suffice, because we do have a couple more bills, but we will accommodate everybody who signed up if you still want to testify. Fire away.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Tom O'Connor, Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. I'll just make it real brief. We represent 11 small municipal electric utilities. We generally try to follow the PUC rules. We do provide notice. We are opposed to this bill, however, because one, there hasn't seemed to be a demonstrated need for this statewide, and why we should do away with the flexibility we have at the local level to design these. And then two, I think our greatest concern is that we don't want to be stuck between the landlord and the tenant on this issue. We want to work with our customers, but we don't want to be in the middle between in landlord-tenant law. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Let's bring up Chris Fick, Mark Landauer, and Marion Hayes.
Money to take care of, right? Mm-hmm. So we got a bit of a catch 22.
Right? Conflict of interest.
Yeah, right. They're going to pay regardless. They just don't understand that.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields, members of the committee. My name is Marion Haynes, and I represent Portland General Electric. I think in previous testimony you heard that for our system, we're regulated by the PUC. They provide significant oversight and administrative rules that deal with our notice provisions and is the appropriate place to deal with that. I think a couple of previous people have spoken to that, and should the PUC decide that we need to make some modifications to the rules and the way that we provide notice to tenants, then we'll engage in that conversation and make changes accordingly. Would be supportive of that kind of a approach to this rather than be included in the specific legislation. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Mark Landauer with the Special Districts Association of Oregon and the Oregon Association of Water Utilities. I'll be brief as possible. The Turpin decision that was previously mentioned does create a requirement for public utilities to provide a reasonable notice. I represent those folks, and we have no issues with the actual notice. We do have some issues with the specifics of this legislation, and I'll quickly summarize those. The gentleman that spoke before me from the Portland Water Bureau hit the nail on the head. We don't know in many instances when there is a landlord-tenant relationship when we are mailing our bills to P.O. boxes. We simply don't know. This bill would require us to provide posting of those instances when that separation exists. Second problem that we have is with the actual posting itself. Two points on that. First, it's sometimes very inefficient to actually do the posting. Notice can be provided by mail. It's done regularly, and many of our systems are set up to do that in the time allotted. That would give a tenant reasonable amount of time. So we don't think a physical notice on single residences makes sense, because we can figure out the service address and mail the notice to the service address when the billing address is different. Finally, I'll just make a quick point. We also oppose the provision in the bill that would require the notice to include the Oregon Law Center's phone number or the Oregon State Bar's phone number. We already have printed notices, and we generally ask those people who are facing a shutoff to call us. We are in the best position to assist these individuals, particularly when they are renters, to get through this process. Our folks want to not shut these people off. It is a last resort to get past payments paid. So in that event, we like to work with the tenants to try to get the landlord to pay up and settle the thing once and for all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it. All right.
If I could just make a comment as you're calling somebody else up. It's my understanding, as the sponsor of the bill and someone working with Ms. Hebb on this, that the purpose of having the Oregon Law Center or the Oregon State Bar information is that this is really geared toward tenants who are in a home or building that is facing foreclosure, and to get information to them about the rights of the tenants in foreclosure, not to have them negotiate with the utility company. So there is a reason for having that information in there. I think hopefully Sybil will nod if I'm correct.
Okay. Good. Thank you very much, Senator Bonamici. I'm afraid I'm going to have to close the hearing at this point. And we've completed the public hearing on this, and hopefully we can come up with something that we can pass out of this committee. So I would encourage you to keep working at it. I'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 490 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 628. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 628 requires counties to annually publish the actual gross monthly salary of each county officer or employee and to identify the title of the positions. It allows the county to identify salary by name of the employee. You have a -1 amendment that deletes the provision that allows the county to identify positions by name of officer or employee. We have a no fiscal and no revenue impact statement for the measure with the -1 amendment, so all the paperwork is in hand that would be necessary to pass the bill, Mr. Chair.
All right. Could we bring up Alex? And Tom, did you want to come up too?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Vice Chair George, I'm Alex Kyler, Intergovernmental Relations Manager for Lane County. This is a measure that is unique to counties. The current statute requires counties to post the names and salaries of employees in the courthouse and in libraries around the county. The bill that you have in front of you would actually amend that to eliminate names of employees and replace that with their positions, and thus the statute will be in line with the way that positions and salaries are made transparent with regards to state employees. So in 2009 you passed the Sunshine Act that provides the exact same thing that this measure would provide in terms of reporting the positions, occupied positions, and the salaries paid in those occupied positions without revealing what we consider to be too much private information about somebody, their actual name. The dash one amendment we asked for to eliminate the sentence that suggested that a county could publish the names. Obviously, a county still could publish the names without that language. The Board of County Commissioners, I suppose, could make that decision. Probably unlikely in this day and age to publish names. We did note that that information about individual employees is available through a public record search, and in the case where there's just one employee with a title, for instance, me in Lane County, then somebody could easily figure out what I actually make. Thank you.
Tom?
Tom Gallagher, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, representing newspaper publishers. First, I'd like to thank Lane County for working with us and bringing us in on this bill at the very beginning and working with us on other bills on public notice. I actually think this is an example where even the posting itself is no longer necessary. It's an archaic activity that worked very well in the horse and buggy days. We have no objection to taking out the list of names. We would support going even further if they wanted. We also worked with these folks on a budget bill that this may come to this committee about budget posting, and we go through the list of all the salaries and how that would be posted, which mixes together newspaper notice and local website notice. So I think this is a good example of a cleanup in statute.
Thank you very much for your testimony, gentlemen. I think there may be additional consideration of other amendments on this, so we're not going to move this today. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 628, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 577.
Would you like me to do an introduction, or do you want Patrick to do that?
No, that would be wonderful if you could tee it up, Senator Bonner.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for scheduling this bill. This bill came from a continuation of work that I started in 2009 in this committee. And we had work group meetings over the interim that were staffed by Cheyenne Ross and Melissa Seidlich from Legislative Council attended. There were many people around the table at most of the meetings. We had somebody from Justice DCBS. Jim Marquis was there on behalf of the collection agency. Various lawyers for consumers, various lawyers for collectors, consumer advocates, banks, credit unions, financial service companies, and debt buyers and an attorney for debt buyers. So we had a lot of people around the table, several meetings, several changes were made along the way to reflect concerns and issues that were raised, but I would be remiss if I didn't say that this is not necessarily a consensus bill out of the work group. It addresses two concerns, debt buyers in their practices and also consumer remedies for unlawful debt collection practices. Debt buyers are typically the large volume debt buying industry. There's been some action taken recently both in a legislature and by attorneys general about the debt buying industry that typically buy large quantities of debt, oftentimes very old debt, for pennies on the dollar and then work on collecting it. So what the bill does in terms of the debt buyers, and I know people will talk about the specifics of the bill with the time that we have, but I want to say that the National Consumer Law Center, which is an advocacy group for low-income Americans, estimates that 1 in 10 debt buyer lawsuits is based on inaccurate information, so there was a lot of concern about that. So what the bill does is consistent with Federal Trade Commission recommendations for all debt collectors. It requires that debt buyers provide a written notice with information before a lawsuit is filed. detailed information about the debt, like the amount of the debt and the identity of the creditor, put the information in the complaint if they do sue the consumer, the information about the identification of the debt and the creditor, because so many of these end up with a default judgment, like somewhere around 80 to 95% end up with a default against the consumer. Also put in the default judgment affidavit the information that this the notices were given. Then with regard to the consumer remedies in the unlawful debt collection practices statute, this would increase the statutory damages for the first time in many, many years. They're now $200 and have been that way, I think, believe since the 70s, to $1,000, which is consistent with the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. It changes the statute of limitations from 1 year to 2 years, and it changes the attorney fee provision to align with our state's Unlawful Trade Practices Act and with the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. So, again, two main categories, the debt buyer provisions and the debt collection provisions are in this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Bonamici. Could we please bring up, how about, as a proponent, Keith Dabanovich?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, my name is Keith Dabanovich. I'm Chief of Staff to Attorney General John Kroger. Senator Bonamici has accurately described the legislation, and I've prepared a good summary, so I won't rehash that. But let me suffice to say by saying that we have a good working relationship with local debt collection companies in the state. One of the initial missions that I was given as once Attorney General took office was to reach out to the debt collection community and to work closely with them. And I frankly think that they've done a good job in the state. Unfortunately, we've not had the same kind of relationship with debt buyers, in part because they're scattered all over the country and if not international in nature. And debt buyers have unfortunately taken up or made up the bulk of the complaints that we're getting about debt collection activities in this state. You may recall complaints raised in the mortgage foreclosure area about a year or so ago involving robo-signing of affidavits in support of foreclosures. Well, unfortunately, we're starting to see that same problem in the debt collection area, and that is robo-signing, essentially people sitting in a room signing dozens of affidavits without really knowing the facts behind the affidavits. And some of the affidavits that we're seeing filed in support of efforts at collecting a debt include lawsuits over debts that are clearly barred by the statute of limitations, lawsuits that are against the wrong person, person never actually owed the debt, and lawsuits that are being filed on a debt that actually had been paid. And a vast majority of these kinds of lawsuits are being filed by debt buyers. The problems that we're seeing include not only the false affidavits, but unfortunately, consumers oftentimes never contest a lawsuit that's been brought against them, in part because when it's brought by a debt buyer, they have no idea who this company is. They never did business with that company. They don't think that they owe any money to that company, so they never contest the lawsuit. And as Senator Bonamici indicated, a lot of those kind of lawsuits actually go into a default judgment. Then they show up on the unsuspecting consumer's credit report, and unfortunately fees can mount with interest and attorney's fees, and so what might have been a $100 debt turns into being a $1,500 or $2,000 debt on their credit report. Some of the complaints that we've gotten about debt buyers include a lady who says she got calls about a debt that was over 7 years old that involved her deceased husband. She requested on a number of occasions to get confirmation in writing, and they never provided it to her, yet the telephone calls continue. One person complained that they received harassing calls from a debt buyer, and each time they asked who was the name of the original creditor, they're met with abusive, argumentative, and questionable conduct. They were yelled at, they were sworn at, and when they were told to stop calling, the person said, "You can't tell me what to do. I don't have to comply with Oregon law." We've had complaints about people getting calls, of course, all time of the day and night, and a lot of people that just generally are trying to find out, do I owe the money, and who is this person that supposedly extended credit to me? And debt buyers often don't have that information, or if they have it, they have not extended that information to the consumer. So the consumer is unfortunately unaware of who they might owe the money to. So as indicated, Senator Bonamici has done a good summary of the bill. My summary also in written testimony outlines what we perceive to be a good improvement to Oregon law, and therefore we're here in support of Senate Bill 577. Happy to answer your questions.
Thank you. Senator Proquist.
I know this is not the Attorney General, but put your old hat on. Previously, Section 3, you know, down towards the bottom of Section 3, there's a remarkable change. Instead of prevailing party gets damages, it's totally different. Prevailing debtor, court may then award, so on and so forth. Is there any, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but is there any real reason to change lines 32 to 36 on page 3-4 of the bill? I mean, that's an Oregon Trial Lawyer Association issue. It doesn't sound to me like it really is going to fix what you just made testimony on.
Chair Shields, Senator Boquist, one of the problems that we've seen is that, as I indicated, a lot of lawsuits are being filed inappropriately, and it may be involving a $1,500 debt. And unfortunately, if you have to go hire a lawyer to defend that kind of case, it actually can exceed the cost of the debt that you may never have owed. So I think that's the rationale behind that provision.
Well, Mr. Chair, but it does
quickly.
Say prevailing party. So if they prevail, they're going to get their bill paid, attorney's fees paid anyway, correct? Under existing statute.
Chair Shields, Senator Boquist, under the existing statute, it did indeed allow prevailing party.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could just respond just a little bit of history on that. When the Oregon Act was passed, it originally had a prevailing consumer or prevailing debtor attorney fee provision, as do many consumer protection statutes, including our unlawful trade practices statute now after a change back to the original. The Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act has that provision as well, similar to in Senate Bill 577. And one of the reasons for it is, even though you said, well, there's a prevailing party now and they'll get their attorney's fees if they recover, is that attorneys, and we have attorneys in the work group who explain this, they need to tell their client when they're talking to them about whether they'll take their case. And there's not a lot of money in representing debtors, frankly. So there's not that many lawyers who do this kind of work. But they have to explain to the consumer, well, I believe you have a claim, but I have to tell you that there is a risk that if for some reason we don't prevail, you may have to pay the other side, the business's attorney's fees. And because of the disparity in the consumer versus the company, that's why many, if not most, consumer protection statutes have prevailing consumer attorney fee provisions. So this is putting it back to the original.
There's got to be a lot of, because they've all been coming through my offices, all those lawyers. So there's more than you think.
let's keep moving. Thank you, Keith, for your testimony. Can we bring up Jim Marquis and Mark Comstock? And I think this is where we're going to have to leave it, unfortunately, for today. Because I have to get to another committee where my wife is testifying and I can't be late.
We're going to have a funeral one.
Welcome to the committee, Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Marquis, here today representing the Oregon Collectors Association, which is an association of about 65 Oregon domiciled collection agencies. I don't represent debt buyers per se. I do have some members that occasionally buy some debt, very, very seldom, probably less than a half a dozen members that ever buy debt. I do have some members that collect accounts for debt buyers, and again, that's probably less than five collection agency members. I've given you some written testimony and a press release that was just released yesterday, actually, by ACA International. I'm here today to oppose this bill, and I did take part in the discussions in Senator Bonamici's work group, and I appreciate the fact that she had everybody at the table and did try to come to some resolution on some issues. However, we simply disagree with the outcome and have to oppose the bill. Section 2 of the bill requires a 30-day notice to debtors if it is a debt buyer account before legal action can be taken, and then and with some specific information about the original creditor, the account number, and all kinds of stuff about the debt. And then again, if you follow through with a lawsuit to the individual, that same information is required again in the pleading. That creates some problems for our folks because it's just going to be burdensome to where you have one path for debts that you're collecting for a debt buyer and a different path if it's any other kind of account. So it wouldn't be the end of the world, but it is cumbersome and we think unnecessary. What I'd like to do though is concentrate most of my testimony relative to Section 3 of the bill, which Senator Boqvist mentioned one provision of that we strongly oppose. There are three provisions in Section 3, all of which apply to everyone in Oregon collecting a debt. This is not about debt buyers. It's not about collection agencies. What you need to realize is that there are two laws in play when it comes to debt collection practices in Oregon. There is the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, and I've included in my testimony an attachment on the background of both the Federal Act and the State Act, the history of complaints, and some of the pertinent cases of interpreting those acts. Under the Federal Act, which was enacted in 1977 by Congress, it only applies to collection agencies, that is, third-party debt collectors. It applies to attorneys collecting debts on behalf of another, and it applies to debt buyers. So there are only three kinds of debt collectors that are covered under the Federal Act. And the Federal Act has all kinds of provisions with do's and don'ts, etc. The State Act, the Oregon Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act, was enacted, I believe, in 1979. And it was modeled after the Federal Act in the beginning, but since that time, both acts have changed, and they're no longer parallel to each other. What we object to in Section 3 of this bill is that we've had a right of private action under this act for many, many years, and the Attorney General regulation of the act was passed by this body in 2009, and I must say that Mr. Dubanovich and Attorney General Kroger have been very, very good to work with, and we have a good working relationship with them, and I think they've just been excellent, and we appreciate the tenor of those communications. However, we think in Section 3 of this bill, raising the damages available to individuals bringing rights of private action from $200 to $1,000 is a little excessive. We wouldn't mind some increase, but we think that's more than should be included. The other two issues are more serious in nature, and that is that this moving away from the prevailing party being allowed attorney fees to a prevailing debtor being allowed attorney fees, and making it more difficult for a defendant to get attorney fees, certainly very serious. What's changed over the years is that we have as Senator Bonamici says, there's not a lot of lawyers that do this work, but there are a number of lawyers that specialize in these kinds of cases from a consumer side. And we are seeing more and more lawsuits against our members for what I would view some little mistake that they've made, where the lawyer files the lawsuit without notice to the collection agency without any opportunity to repair any damage that might have been done by a mistake. And the cases, there is a case that brought in, while the original act said only willful violations were a violation, it had to be a willful act to be a violation, there is a case that said basically willful under this act means nothing more than ordinary negligence in not knowing something you should have known. So we have ordinary negligence as a standard in this act, and we have a lot of lawsuits over that very thing. So it makes it easier for a consumer lawyer to bring these actions and much more difficult on our members. And many of them just, we believe, shouldn't be brought. So the third thing is the statute of limitations that Senator Bonamici didn't mention, I think, in her opening remarks. And right now there is a statute of limitations of 1 year from the date of injury for these actions under the right of private action provision. And this bill would change that to 2 years from the date of discovery. That could be 20 years. We have no idea how many years that might be from the date of discovery. I don't know. Discovery means I discovered that it was illegal, or I discovered the injury. I don't know. So we're very strongly opposed to that extension of the statute of limitations.
Thank you, Jim. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Shields. Members of the committee, my name is Mark Comstock. I'm a lawyer here in private practice in Salem. I appear before you on behalf of DBA International, which is a trade organization which includes debt buyers, collection attorneys, and other credit agencies from across the nation. I believe that Senator Bonamici did do a good summary of the bill, as did Mr. Dubanovich. I did participate in the work group at times, but I want to just summarize that instead of going over all of the information in my written testimony. I think that the key thing on behalf of DBA International is this is not necessary legislation because it is all covered by the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, and that act does make debt buyers subject to its provisions. Section 2 is something that is required under or for the most part under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And it's really covered. I believe the Attorney General's recent assurance of voluntary compliance in Eugene showed that it was the federal act that was the basis of the action there. What I'm concerned about is that there is additional workload on the courts that doesn't exist currently in the form of additional documentation for affidavits. And finally, the last point I wanted to make was there built into this bill in Section 3 is confusion over the statute of limitations. And Mr. Marquis identified briefly what that was. Quite frankly, Section 3.3 of the bill says that the action shall be commenced within 2 years of the discovery of the unlawful collection practice. Well, that's different. That's a different standard than it is currently in other statutes that have a discovery provision. For example, 12.110, or S 12.110, has a further limitation on that discovery standard, and that is, or in the exercise of reasonable care, should have been discovered. Well, that is a substantial limitation, and it also is an area that has been litigated in Oregon, so we have some idea of what that standard is, and that's absent from this version of the bill. In summary, it's a flawed concept, and it's not necessary for state legislation on this, as the federal act covers it. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, gentlemen. Quick question?
No, I just wanted to make a comment. Mr. Marquis talked about how there were two different paths if this passes, one for debt buyers and one for collection agencies. There isn't anything that would prohibit the collection agencies from also giving the notice and including the information. Correct. In their complaint. So there don't really have to be two paths.
And just for record, I am challenged by Section 3, but I'm not impressed by the federal government either, which is totally unrelated.
All right, thank you, gentlemen. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 577. And I believe that we are adjourned, or do we have any other business?
No, and if you want to announce, we're planning to roll that and send SJM 10 over. That's fine. We're outside the posting requirement, so it's not necessary to announce.
All right, we're going to, the comments that the committee administrator just made, that's what we're going to roll over. And we are adjourned. Thank you.